Hello and welcome to another episode of BSL Radio. I'm very excited today to have Dr. Larry Young join us. He is going to be talking about his book, The Chemistry Between Us, Love, Sex, and the Science of Attraction. And he has a co-author, Brian Alexander, who's not on the call today. But Dr. Young is one of the world's leading experts in the field of social behavioral neuroscience. He is the William P. Timmy Professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Director of the Center for Translational Social Neuroscience at Emory University and the Chief of the Division of Behavioral Science and Psychiatric Disorders at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. Larry is in the editorial boards of many organizations. He has been the associate editor of the Frontiers in Behavioral Neuroscience, Pharmacology, Biochemistry, Behavior, and Hormones and Behavior. He reviews manuscripts for every major journal in this field, including Science and Nature. In 2008, he received the prestigious Golden Brain Award from the Minerva Foundation, which recognizes significant contributions to brain research. In 2009, he was elected as a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, this country's most prestigious science society. And he has authored or co-authored nearly 200 research papers, essays, review articles, and much, much more. Welcome, Larry. We really appreciate having you here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I also have my partner in crime here, Dylan. And we have a dog as well.
Yes, that's a problem.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We have a special guest. So I like that.
Special guest. Yeah, you're in the show today. Yes, I think today we have a great show planned for you guys because a lot of times love, sex, and attraction isn't looked at through the lens of the science behind it. What's going on in your brain, in your body, the biochemistry, the neuroscience behind it. Because these are all things that play a role in what's really happening. And so we'll let Dr. Young do it, talk more about how he came upon these theories and how he met Brian Alexander, his co-author.
Okay, yeah, so I've been working in this field of social neuroscience since around 1994, and I got into it because I was really interested in understanding how the brain controls our behavior, things like sexual behavior and social behavior. And I began working on these little rodents called prairie voles, which we discuss a lot in the book. And these guys are really neat because they, like humans, when a male and female come together, they form a bond. And that bond usually lasts a lifetime. And so we have other kinds of voles that look very similar, but they don't form any kind of bonds whatsoever. In fact, they're pretty asocial. So we were able to do experiments by looking in the brain to try to see what is different between these species that allows one of them to be able to form these lifelong bonds and the other not. And what we found is that there's a molecule called oxytocin, which plays a really important role in the formation of that bond. Now, oxytocin, many people may have heard of that. It's a molecule that's produced in the mother when she's giving birth. It helps progress the labor. And after the baby is born, when the baby is nursing, oxytocin is released from the brain to cause milk to be ejected so that the baby can get nourishment. But it was also understood that oxytocin acts in the brain of the mother to cause her to form this bond between the mother and the baby. This mother-infant bond is one of the most powerful bonds there is in the animal kingdom. And so this molecule is involved in that bond between the mother and the offspring, so we thought maybe this molecule may also be involved in the bond between the prairie voles, between the adults. And so we were able to show that if we could take a prairie vole, normally they have to mate in order to form these bonds, we could inject oxytocin into their brain, and they would bond instantly. So this was sort of our first indication that, you know, there's a chemical in the brain that helps individuals form these bonds. And since then, we've done a lot more work that I can talk about later. But because of this work, people got really excited because, hey, this tells us something about the chemistry of love. And a few years ago, Nature, which is one of the most prestigious science journals, asked me if I would write an essay about what neuroscience can tell us about love. And So I wrote this essay, and it got really a lot of attention. It was published all over the world in terms of magazines and newspapers. And so from that, I saw the excitement that came through that, and I thought, wait, this may be a good topic for a book. And so I contacted one of the people that wrote a really interesting article about my essay, and his name was Brian Alexander. He's a writer for MSNBC, and I really liked the way he wrote about the science, and I thought it would be a great opportunity to team up with someone who knows how to write in a way that the public can really appreciate. And so we teamed up together and wrote the book in just a couple of years.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's great. It's, I think it's important to connect with the right people, and sometimes you have to meet people where they're at to really share a message that you have or information.
Yep.
So maybe you can talk about starting off the book. I know an interesting topic is really talking about how much, you know, how much control do we have over love and our emotions and our attraction to other people. And I guess the question about, you know, really, is there free will? And I think that's an interesting topic when we talk about, you know, biochemistry and what goes on.
Right. That's a natural question that comes up. And what we have determined is, you know, in addition to oxytocin, there's other molecules like dopamine and opiates and vasopressin, and they're acting within very specific neural circuits to create behaviors like bonding, but also, you know, sexual desire and all of these things. And so the question comes up is, if this is all driven by chemistry and chemical reactions, do we have, in fact, any free will at all? And I'm sort of on the fence about that. I think that, you know, ultimately we are driven by the physical laws of nature and these chemical reactions. But I think that, you know, the important thing is that we experience free will. We think that we have free will. We think that we can make decisions about our lives. And I think that's the most important thing. So, you know, I think it would be a mistake for people to say, well, there really is no free will, so I might as well do this because I'm destined to do it. So I don't think that that is the approach that people should take at all.
Well, how much does what we think affect our neural processes as far as, you know, maybe our setting our neural pathways and what we continue to think?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think, well, what we do know is that what we experience affects our neural processes. So, for example, we know that, for example, in girls who hear their mother's voice, their brain releases oxytocin. Mm-hmm. If they interact with their mother, their brain releases oxytocin. If they get a text from their mother, their brain does not release oxytocin. And so even when we interact with our pets, if our pets lock gazes with us, we release this oxytocin. So I imagine that if we think about a loved one, think about our children or our lover, then that probably also causes release of oxytocin and dopamine, which then can, you know, affect many aspects of our behavior.
Wow, that's kind of interesting. Yeah, that makes me think of all the social media and how people are settling for these fake interactions that happen through. And I don't want to say they're fake, but like you said, a text message isn't going to release the brain chemical of, you know, that makes you feel good things or whatnot that a face-to-face interaction can, right?
Right. See, it's these social stimuli. It's looking in the eyes of another. It's seeing their facial expression. Our brains have evolved to detect that and to respond to that. And, you know, this is really important, say, in children, developing children and babies, that they see their mother's face or their father's face, and they have that touch. And, you know, there's something about a real physical interaction that releases these molecules, and especially in children, releasing those molecules helps develop the social circuits that allows them to have relationships later in life. And, you know, I'm afraid that people nowadays are they rely too much on email for all their communication rather than a phone call. This is also a social stimulus.
Okay.
Rely on emails, Facebook, all of these things, and we think of we have these relationships, but really, I think we're missing something. We should try to really strive for having more face-to-face conversations.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What is it? I think that. What about physical attraction, and how does that work into all of this? Because I think that's another question that, I mean, I know a lot of people, we get questions on is how do you enhance that or what detracts from that between two people? Is that something predetermined in your head or happen, you know, what kind of goes on to kind of increase that?
Well, attraction starts before love, and there's a component of lust, basically sexual desire, the object of sexual desire. And different people have different things that they're attracted to. For example, for some reason, all of my partners, most of them, have been curly-headed blonde women. I'm curly-headed blonde women. And that comes from our experiences. We talk about how our book, how our brain, as we're developing, begins to make connections between certain features or certain things in our environment and reward and pleasure. And so, for example, if our first girlfriend was a redhead or something like that, and we really enjoyed that relationship, our brain sort of makes that connection and sort of drives us to be attracted to a person like that. There may also be, you know, components of our parents. As we're young, we see certain behaviors or certain hairstyles or features in our parents, and that sort of becomes ingrained in our brain, and those features become attractive to us.
Interesting. So I guess at some point is attraction a choice? Are the experiences kind of leading you to who you're attracted to?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's always a choice, and we can, you know, choose who we like. But underneath that, there are neural mechanisms that are driving us in particular directions. And I think that's really the important thing of the book, is that it's not that those chemicals are completely dictating our behavior and making us do these things, but rather the chemical study in animals and shown that are driving behavior in humans, they are really just creating motivations to do certain things. In animals, they're much more powerful. For example, we talk about sexual behavior. If you have a pair of rats and the female is in estrus, which means she's in heat, she's sexually attractive, and you put a male in the cage, that male is going to mate with that female no matter what. His brain is telling him that female is really sexually attractive and to mate. Humans, males and females interact all the time, and there may be this, or there is a part of our brain that is sort of saying to you, hey, this is an attractive person. Wouldn't it be great to have sex with this person? But we also have a part of our brain called the cortex, which sort of puts a brake on that and tells us, hey, this is not the right situation to do that. We describe it in the book as sort of two Daffy Ducks, an angel Daffy Duck and a devil Daffy Duck that are sitting on each shoulder. One is these chemicals that are telling you, hey, you know, this person is really attractive, we could have sex. And then the angel Daffy Duck is saying, hey, wait a second, this is your boss's wife. This is not a good idea to do this.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yep. Another question I have is on the relationships you have growing up and developing, you know, as a child and how that affects you moving forward. So maybe you can talk about that. And also, if you know that you might come from a place where you're not getting a lot of attention as a child, is there things that you could do to, like, counteract that moving forward? So,
Well, clues about how early life experience affects our ability to form relationships later in life comes from our work in these prairie voles that I was mentioning. We find that For example, if we just take away the father so that the offspring are raised by the mother alone, which means that they get less time with a parent on the nest, when those pups grow up, they have a much more difficult time forming their bond. We also show that if we just take the pups away from their parents every day for 3 hours a day, when they become adults, they have a difficult time forming a bond as well. So this work in animals tells us that the nurturing, the attention that we get from our parents helps build these social circuits that then allow us to have relationships later in life. And we found that if we enrich those experiences, we can build even stronger neural circuits for social bonding. And in humans, there's pretty good evidence that the same thing is happening. We talk in the book about Romanian orphanages where the children really got very little attention, very little nurturing from anyone. And those children, when they become adults, many of them have a very difficult time assimilating into society, just showing emotions or really even understanding the emotions of others. So it can really have a big impact. And I think if someone is in an environment where they did not get the nurturing experience or abusive environment, I think that those people would need to be put themselves in a situation where they get lots of social experiences later, you know, force themselves to be around others and interact with others and sort of try to revitalize those social circuits. We did a study at Emory where we looked at women who, when they were young girls, they experienced abuse or neglect, and we took a sample of their cerebral spinal fluid and measured oxytocin, and we found that those women who, as children, experienced that abuse and neglect, as adults, they had lower oxytocin levels. And we think that this may have some impact on how they relate to others, how they trust others. There's been a lot of work in humans now that's followed up on our vole work that looks at what oxytocin does in the brain. And so, for example, people can sniff oxytocin and then see how it affects their behavior. And one of the interesting things that has come from that work is that sniffing oxytocin actually increased trust for others. It increases empathy. It increases the ability to read the emotions of others. So you can imagine that in people who experience that early life abuse and neglect and have lower levels of oxytocin in their brain, they may have less trust for others, less empathy. And that can have an impact on lots of different aspects of relationships.
Can you give yourself that sort of that love and nurturing, and can you through that release the oxytocin yourself?
Well, there haven't been any studies to really show that you could do that, but I imagine that if you think about loved ones, you think about your partner, you think about your child, that you probably can release these molecules. You know, I think it's like, you know, having good thoughts and thinking about relationships and others is probably stimulating the same kinds of molecules, maybe not to the same degree, but to some extent. And I think that that will likely have a positive impact on, you know, how you relate to others.
You know, one of the things we work on heavily with clients is social anxiety. And the prescription we give them, at least at some point or another, is to go out and meet, you know, hundreds of people every week. Go out, work, meet them through charity events, you know, volunteer, do whatever you have to, but build these social connections, get yourself in front of different people, you know, practice the habit of giving and just interacting and connecting with people and connecting them to each other at the same time. And it's amazing how it dissolves their own issues in the process. And you know, I'm just curious how the, you know, the, from the biochemistry aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
I guess it sounds like to me that what's happening there on the science side of it is that all these chemicals are firing up because it's so much experience driven, right?
Right. You know, I mentioned that oxytocin is released in the mother when she's nursing, and
mm-hmm.
that does two things. That causes the mother to focus her attention on that baby. That baby becomes the most important thing in that mother's world. But oxytocin
mm-hmm.
also is anxiolytic, which means it reduces anxiety. So mothers will often say when they are nursing, they have this very strong sense of well-being and calmness. So that's the other side of oxytocin. So I think that what you're describing is when people have these frequent social interactions that are positive, it's they're experiencing the calmness, the calming effect of that oxytocin. And so I think that you're absolutely right. You know, one way to reduce your social anxiety is just to expose yourself to people and have those social interactions. You'll get the release of oxytocin probably, but you're also, your brain will make the association that, hey, being around people is not a bad thing. It's actually pleasurable. And so then eventually that'll create a drive in you to interact more, to try to recreate that positive experience.
Wow, that's fantastic. So I guess you could take that also to visualizations, I guess. We've been talking about that as well. So people are visualizing, you know, creating a great life or creating things that would also have, I mean, an effect as well. I mean, by releasing chemicals because you're
right.
Seeing things in your mind.
Right. I don't think that anyone has actually ever shown that in people. And because this is really a new field, it's really in the past 10 or 15 years that we've been able to make the insights that we have already. But I think that you're absolutely right, that if you visualize something positive, a social interaction, you know, that you probably are creating these chemical reactions in the brain.
Interesting. Maybe you can talk about the other how people with oxytocin in people that are actually in relationships, how they can sort of revitalize the relationship. Because a lot of times you hear people, a very common thing, or we're going through a dry spell, or, you know, our, you know, interactions, or how I feel that about that person is waning, or there's some other thing that's going on in the relationship that makes them feel not that close to each other.
Right.
And what could people, you know, do based on the science and things that you've been looking at?
Mm-hmm. So our work with voles has shown that, you know, it's the sexual activity, the intimate sexual relationships between these animals creates the release of oxytocin, but also dopamine. Dopamine is a drug that gives you the feeling of exhilaration and excitement. And that of course happens when you have sex or even when you have really intimate moments. And it's the combination of that oxytocin and dopamine working together that really creates that bond between the two individuals. And early in the relationship, there's lots of oxytocin and dopamine being released because the people are always together. You know, the chemistry of falling in love is very similar to the chemistry of addiction. The same brain areas are involved, dopamine is involved, opiates are involved, and so it's a very exciting and exhilarating time. But as relationships get longer and longer, oftentimes there is less sexual activity. You know, people stop having sex as frequently as they once did, and the relationship really changes. It's not so much excitement anymore, but people are just, they're bonded and they certainly want to be together, but that excitement is gone. And I think that by understanding the chemistry of what's going on in the brain to help create that spark in the first place, we can think about how we might change our behaviors in order to recreate that chemistry. So, for example, I think that the best thing that can happen to a relationship is for people to increase their sexuality. Have more intimate moments. And maybe to combine that with something that's exciting, because this is going to help release more dopamine. So maybe have an exciting date or go to an exotic location, go on a vacation somewhere, and really strive to increase your sexual intimacy. And, you know, I think it's just common sense that that's going to help a relationship, but it also makes sense from a biochemical point of view. So I think that the more we know about how to stimulate these chemicals and what those chemicals are doing, you know, we can modify our behaviors in a way that can help us in these relationships.
You know, what else do you recommend? What else can a couple do to keep the excitement going?
You know, it really is the intimacy between you. It's not just sex, but, you know, having a conversation, looking in each other's eyes, make an effort to make the other person know that you care about them. This sparks this oxytocin release as well. So it really is all about these kinds of things that can stimulate the oxytocin and the dopamine, the feeling of intimacy between each other. That's really what needs to be done.
Yeah, so it's like the combination of the frequency of contact and, you know, the excitement factors in terms of novelty, so like going on different dates,
right,
and doing adventures.
You know, sometimes people will say, well, if love is really all about oxytocin and dopamine, then, you know, I don't really need to give my wife flowers on Valentine's Day. And that's actually not true, because those flowers are showing her that you really care about her and that you've gone out of your way to get something for her, to please her. And that right there is causing those chemical changes in the brain. So, you know, don't think that just because it's chemistry that these other little things don't matter. They actually matter quite a lot.
Interesting. So does that go back to some social cues? Like, because at a Valentine's Day is obviously a human construct. And so I'm wondering if some of these social cues that go on around in the world the construct that we live inside of, that also plays in part of it, something like Valentine's Day where people equate an emotion to an event, because that's what everyone does. And so by not doing that, you kind of go the opposite way. If you're a man and you say, well, I don't want to give her flowers because what does this really matter? But then she has a feeling towards that specific day or time or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of...
Right. There's a certain expectation that, you know, that if he loves me, you know, in this society, he would give me flowers, or he would give me chocolate, or give me things, whatever. And, you know, maybe different societies have different things, different ways that people can show their love for each other. But still, it's the perception, it's the brain's perception of this person really cares about me, and they're doing this thing which society knows is a sign that he loves me. So one of the, you know, the best things that I can do if my relationship with my wife is a little bit in trouble on Valentine's Day is to get a big vase of flowers and have it sent to her work, so that not only does she get the flowers, but everyone there can see that I have made this gesture of my love for her. And, you know, that has a huge impact on her behavior when she comes home. You know, she's all excited and everything is all positive. So, you know, I think we need to keep those things in mind. But I want to touch on something else that's kind of interesting about in terms of oxytocin and relationships. This was a study that was published last year where a German group gave men who were either in a monogamous relationship or they were single, gave them a sniff of oxytocin, and then they had an attractive woman, an attractive experimenter, stand at a certain distance from that man and then walk towards that man. And they asked the man to tell her to stop when he began to feel uncomfortable. So it's a measure of personal space, right? And they thought, well, maybe oxytocin, since that facilitates relationships and affiliation, that maybe oxytocin would make the man want the attractive female to stop closer to him. And actually what happened was in the monogamous men who were in a, you know, long-term relationship, they actually began to feel uncomfortable at a further distance. So they asked the female to stop further away than if they got placebo. And for the single men, oxytocin had no effect whatsoever. And so the authors conclude that, well, maybe what oxytocin is doing in this situation is, because they're in a monogamous relationship, it's actually helping the male to keep women who may be a temptation further away, sort of to maintain the monogamous relationship with your partner. And so maybe this is a mechanism of maintaining relationships. So I thought that was really interesting.
It
seems to be not only creating that bond between you, but also helping to maintain it by preventing you from having temptations.
Does that work the same way for women as well, or is there a different process?
Well, I don't know. It was only done in men, so I can't really say that. But I imagine it probably is a very similar process. So the authors concluded, you know, if women want to keep their men faithful, you know, one way to do that is to keep their oxytocin levels high. And, of course, we've already discussed how you do that. So that's another benefit from having, you know, frequent intimate relationships and sexual activity.
Wow. What is, and I've got a question, why do people drunk dial their exes? Because I think that's a phenomenon. I just have some interesting questions around some of these topics that I know people would definitely be interested in hearing. And what you know, how does the brain chemistry and the chemistry of the body play into all that?
Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned before, we have these two Daffy Ducks on our shoulder. One is an angel and one's the devil, and one is The devil one is always telling us to do things, you know, that would create excitement and maybe sexual contact or whatnot. The other one is our prefrontal cortex, which is putting the brakes on our behavior. So we have these deep brain urges that are telling us, hey, you should do this. But then our cortex, our prefrontal cortex is saying, hey, this is not appropriate. You don't really want to do this. This is going to cause trouble or whatnot. And what happens when we get drunk is that prefrontal cortex activity goes down. And so it has less of a brake on these subcortical drives that we have. So, you know, if we're thinking about our ex, you know, and maybe, hey, maybe I could call her and we can hook up somehow. But the prefrontal cortex is not telling you, hey, that is a very bad idea, then you may go ahead and do that.
Interesting. Is that the same in both men and women?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes, so we both have that prefrontal cortex that is giving us, you know, reasoning ability to think about all the different things that might happen. And that subcortical part of our brain is not really thinking much at all. It's sort of giving you impulses to do this. And we really have to have both of these going on, you know, at the same time if we're going to, you know, behave in a society in an acceptable way, but you know, that's one of the things that alcohol does, is it just sort of silences that prefrontal cortex.
Yep.
You know, this is really interesting how the biochemistry and how these chemicals release regarding love and attraction and sex for men and women work exactly the same way and release the same way due to the same types of experiences. But the perceptual filters are different for each men and women.
Right. Well, also, I haven't mentioned another molecule that plays a really important role in men, and that's vasopressin. Vasopressin is similar to oxytocin in terms of molecular structure, but it's a little bit different. And vasopressin is a chemical in the brain that is stimulated by testosterone. So males have a lot more testosterone than females do, and therefore we have a more vasopressin. And, you know, as I mentioned before, oxytocin is originally evolved for maternal bonding, maternal nurturing. Vasopressin in other animals does things like increases territorial behavior, scent marking. You know, if you walk a dog, you know, the dog will go and pee on every single mailbox in the neighborhood, and what he's doing is marking off his territory. And in animals, vasopressin does that. It increases aggression to defend the territory. And so we know in prairie voles, vasopressin increases aggression to towards others, but it also creates that bond between the male and the female. So for in males, you have both the oxytocin, but also this vasopressin component. And I think that, you know, monogamy evolved by tweaking these systems, the oxytocin system, which was involved in maternal bonding, and then this vasopressin system in males that is involved in territorial behavior. Those things became tweaked as we evolved, you know, the ability to form bonds. And now the vasopressin component is basically telling the brain that that your partner is an extension of your territory. And so there's elements of aggression and, I'd say, jealousy. Vasopressin, you know, unlike oxytocin, which is very anxiolytic and calming, vasopressin is a little bit more, creates vigilance. And so there may be some, or certainly there are some differences in the neurochemistry of love and bonding between men and women.
Okay. Awesome. In the Infidelity Paradox chapter in your book, The Chemistry Between Us, you make a distinction between social monogamy and sexual monogamy.
Right.
What is the Infidelity Paradox all about?
Well, first let me just say something about social monogamy versus sexual monogamy. For biologists, at least, when we think about monogamy in animals, we are mostly thinking about social monogamy, which means that a male and female pair together and they spend some time together, maybe their entire life, you know, raising offspring together as partners. But what we know when we go and do genotyping of offspring, for example, is that both the male and the female often have extra pair copulations. So they have sex outside the relationship. So in animals that have the same kind of mating system as humans, which actually is very rare, only 3% of mammals have a pair bonding relationship like humans. But even those that do, that we think of as being, you know, truly monogamous, they are not really sexually monogamous. So I think that, you know, in humans, it's a very similar thing. Many people can go through their entire life in a relationship and never have an affair, but a remarkably high percentage of people do actually have affairs. And so even though we have in our brain these mechanisms that drive us to form these relationships so that we can raise our children together, there are other parts of our brain that are creating these sexual desires for others. And, you know, that results in somewhere between 10 and 12% of children do not belong to the father who they think is their father, and if the father also thinks that he's the father.
So, interesting.
Yeah.
That is it.
And there's an evolutionary advantage to that at least we think in animals that for a female, you know, what her brain should tell her to do is to keep that male in the relationship because he can provide protection and resources. But if she can go, if she sees another male who is genetically very fit, who looks healthy and strong, it's to her advantage maybe to sneak out and to get pregnant by that male to increase the genetic diversity of her offspring. And for the male, the advantage is if he can sneak off and have sex with others and have more offspring, then he's genetically more fit. He's created more more babies that carry his genes. So, you know, our behavior is really shaped by our evolutionary history.
So is that pretty much the underlying reasoning for why people cheat? Basically, does it just boil down to that aspect of evolutionary biology?
Yes, I think that is the ultimate reason of why our brains are organized the way they are. To maximize our fitness, to maximize the number of offspring that we can create that have our genes. And, you know, that doesn't mean that it's okay to do that. I personally don't think that it's okay to have an affair. I would hate for my wife to have an affair, and she would hate for if I did as well. So it's not at all a, you know, something to say that it's okay to do. It's just the fact that this is our evolutionary history.
Mm.
And you know, another interesting question is, why did we evolve to form relationships in the first place?
Right.
And it's
right.
Likely because of the extended dependence of the baby on the mother. You know, the human babies nurse for 3 to 4 years, and really for the first couple of years are really totally dependent on the mother. And so you can imagine that if we were like most other species where the male and female come together and they have sex and then they go their separate ways, it would be very difficult for a female to raise the offspring, you know, in our evolutionary history. So it would, you know, the successful offspring are being raised by both parents who are providing resources and my guests are back.
Your guests are back.
Yes.
Okay.
Interesting. So why do people stay in abusive relationships or bad relationships then, out of curiosity? Because that would seem sort of counter in some ways to some of these things, potentially.
Well, I think that this comes back to the idea that bonding, love, and bonding is very similar in nature to addiction. They both involve this dopamine, and we know that in relationships there are changes in the brain over time so that the relationship is driven not just by the release of dopamine and the excitement of being together, but it's being maintained by this negative feeling that we feel when we're without the partner. So we show in voles, for example, if they are pair bonded and together, and then we take away their partner, they become totally depressed. There are changes in chemistry in the brain, like a molecule called CRF, that goes up that creates anxiety and really depression. They just give up in difficult situations. Well, I think that this is very similar to the aspect of addiction that is withdrawal. Addicts, they begin taking drugs because it feels really good and it's exciting. But after a long time, even though that drug is causing bad things to happen in their life, they continue to do it because it relieves that negative feeling of withdrawal. And I think the same thing happens in relationships. If you're without your partner, you begin to feel this longing feeling and negative affect. And the only way to get rid of that is to go back and be with your partner. And sometimes that can be even stronger than, you know, the negative experiences that you have if your partner is abusive.
Interesting. Well, next question I wanted to talk about, you know, on the clinical side of things, we talked about this before we got on the call right now, on the radio show. Just talk about how that's going to – I'm curious to seeing how, you know, things like autism and schizophrenia and things that you're kind of working on relate to all of these things, as well as people who have anxiety disorders, and just maybe discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, actually – this is the reason that I'm actually doing the work that I'm doing. I get money from the National Institute of Health not to understand why we fall in love and how to make people stay in love, but really it's to understand the social brain. How do we relate to others? Because there are disorders like autism where there is something is broken in the brain so that they are not able to relate to others as well. Autistic individuals tend not to be rewarded by social interactions. They don't look into the eyes of others. They don't have the ability to read the emotions of others. And they just have a very awkward social interactions. And what I believe, what's driving my research, is that if we can harness the chemistry that happens in a mother when she's nursing a baby, where, you know, she becomes incredibly social at that point. Her brain is focusing on that baby. If we can harness the chemistry that is involved in that we may be able to increase the activity of the social brain in disorders like autism and even in schizophrenia and some other disorders. So, and there's actual evidence that that is true. There are several studies that have shown that if you take individuals with autism and give them intranasal oxytocin, they do look into the eyes of others more. They do engage in social reciprocity, play games with others more. We're just at the very beginning of this research, and I certainly at this point, parents should not be rushing out to try to give their kids oxytocin because there can also be some negative effects. And we're trying to understand better, you know, how to properly use this. But to me, that's what's exciting. That's what's keeping me, you know, excited in my research, is that we actually now know how to affect the chemistry in the brain so that the brain is more interested in social information that can help these people who have deficits in the ability to relate to others to be able to begin to be able to relate to others. And what we're working on now is actually identifying drugs that can stimulate the brain to release oxytocin, just like occurs in a mother when she's nursing. And, you know, we have some of these drugs that we've given to voles, and it really rapidly creates the bond between the two. And in autism, we're not really trying to create a bond, but what we're just trying to do is to open up that the brain's mechanisms of perceiving social information and processing that. There are also other investigators that are working on social anxiety, giving intranasal oxytocin and showing that it improves the anxiety that people have when they're in a social situation. So I think that this is an area that's going to be very exciting to follow in the future, and I think some really important discoveries are going to come from that work.
Fantastic. I have another question going back to our other topic on love, sex, and relationships. So why do people go to strip clubs, out of curiosity? I mean, is there some thing that makes a connection to all this?
Well, more men go to strip clubs than women. Men tend to be more visual. And part of that has to do with, again, our evolutionary history. For men, if they could see someone and identify them as an attractive female or a fertile female and have sex with that person, and they could have babies, and they could do that 10 times a day. You know, sperm is cheap. For women, it's very different, because once you find that one person that you have sex with and you get pregnant, then you're going to have one baby, and you're going to be pregnant for the next 9 months. So women's brain have to be much more choosy. And so they choose not just on visual cues, but much more about, you know, the character of the person, what kind of partner are they going to be. Whereas for men, they're much more visual, and you know, their parts of the brain that are involved in sexuality respond very strongly to visual sexual cues. And it's interesting, one thing that's very different between humans and any other mammalian species is that human males are fascinated by females' breasts. No other species do the female actually develop enlarged breasts before they give birth. Breasts are only for nurturing the offspring. But in humans, it's, you know, stimulation of the breast and attraction to the breast is part of our sexuality. And I think that there are brain mechanisms that have evolved to make men attracted to breasts and to want to stimulate those breasts. And the consequence of that is that you're creating the same stimulation that a mother, you know, experiences when she's nursing. Stimulation of the breasts and the nipples causes oxytocin release. And so this may be a brain mechanism that helped forge the bond between the female and the male partner. Now, back to the strip clubs, it's kind of interesting. We talk about in the second chapter about how women's behavior actually changes with their fertility. So there was a study where they looked at strippers in strip clubs and recorded how much money they made over their ovarian cycle, over their menstrual cycle. And they found that when the women were fertile, they actually made significantly more money. Now, that suggests that something about the women were more attractive to the men during that time, and I think that most likely it was their behavior. They were feeling more sexy. So even though women can have sexual desire any time during their cycle, there are certain times, like when she's ovulating, when her brain really revs up those parts of the brain that are involved in sexuality. So, you know, we often think that women's sexual behavior doesn't really change that much based on hormones, but there's quite a bit of evidence that they do.
Interesting. What about sexual fetishes too? Because that's something I just out of curiosity. Like, what is that? Is there chemistry in that? Because I mean, how does someone like something, you know, completely different than someone else? You know, whatever that might be. Is that anything that can do with chemistry or behavioral? Or if you've looked at that,
this sort of gets back to that question that you asked earlier: why we are attracted to certain characteristics of people. And I was talking about the blonde curly hair. Sometime early in my experience, I maybe had a relationship with someone who had blonde curly hair, and then my brain made that connection between that experience and blonde curly hair. And so now I sort of have that drive. Well, that same sort of thing can happen to all kinds of stimuli that don't have to do with the body at all. So, for example, I'll tell you a study that was done in rats. That's kind of interesting. This work was done by Jim Faust, where he took male rats and exposed them to females, and he put on the female a chemical called cadaverine, which is the molecule that causes cadavers to have the awful smell. And rats normally don't like cadaverine; that they avoid it because that means that there's somebody dead around, something dead around, and therefore it's dangerous. But if he gave those male rats females that were scented with cadaverine every day, so they had sex with those females for 14 days, then later, if he just gave that male the scent of cadaverine, he developed erections, became sexually excited. So that, I think, is a fetish. And it's caused by the release of the dopamine when the animal is having sex, while at the same time they're smelling this chemical, cadaverine, and their brain is making a connection that, hey, whenever there is cadaverine, there's going to be dopamine release, and it's exciting. And so that rat then develops a fetish for cadaverine. And, you know, you can think about, well, like lots of men have shoe fetishes. And Jim Faust, who did the study I just mentioned, suggests that maybe shoe fetishes can develop if a young boy experiences his first sexual experiences maybe in his mother's closet where there's lots of shoes around or something like that. And then the brain links those shoes to that sexual experience. And then for some reason that, as that male grows up, he's always attracted to sexy shoes.
Interesting. And the last question I have is, and a question that people often ask in general, is that after they get a relationship that ends, or maybe they don't want it to end, like, what's the best way to get over an ex and, you know, start to move on with your life?
In my opinion, the best way to get over your ex is to go out and establish new relationships with other people and try to find another relationship. Because as soon as you can, when your relationship dissolves, as I mentioned, you have this increase in CRF, these molecules that increase the stress axis and tend to induce this depression-like behavior. And we can actually block that in the prairie voles by giving injections of oxytocin into the brain. So oxytocin release can relieve the depression that a vole experiences when he loses his partner. But from that, I suspect that in a human who, you know, just had a bad relationship, rather than sitting around and ruminating on that relationship and ruminating on that loss, try to go out and spark these chemicals in your brain with someone else.
So maybe, it's a myth. You would say it's a myth from a brain science perspective to hold off on, you know, grieving or
right,
you know, reflecting on the relationship and to just go back in there.
Yeah, well, I think that you do want to take some time to grieve. Certainly if you lost a partner, grieving for a short amount of time can be healthy. And, you know, in a divorce, obviously, you know, you need to take some time to reflect. But if it begins to become pathological and really disruptive in your life, then what you should do is go back out there. But you want to make sure that you don't, you know, try to go in for the wrong reasons and fall into a relationship with someone that is not really healthy for you.
Yeah. So not to get into
that's a danger, of course.
Yeah. Not to get into not necessarily to get into another relationship, but you recommended to just go out there and start interacting at least.
Yeah.
To block the other chemical you said that would induce depression, you said?
Right. So the CRF is what's causing that depression. And the oxytocin that you can get from not just like a sexual relationship, but interacting with others, looking into their eyes, you know, making a connection with another person.
Sure.
Stimulate that oxytocin release and sort of get rid of that negative affect that comes along with the loss and that CRF expression.
Awesome.
Interesting.
That's great.
Yeah, fantastic. Dylan, do you have anything else?
I think we hit it all. I think there's some interesting points, and this discussion can go on for days, I bet. I'm sure Dr. Young has plenty of things he could share with us even more. So thank you for being on the show today, Dr. Young. Where can people find out more about you and what you're up to?
If you just do a Google search for Larry Young and Emory, you'll come up to my lab website, and you can see a lot of the work that we've been doing and the different research projects that are going on. You can also go to the Center for Translational Social Neuroscience website, which is www.ctsn.emory.edu, and you can see the larger group of investigators at Emory that are both trying to understand the chemistry and the biology of the social brain and how to use that to treat disorders like autism and schizophrenia. And then, of course, you can read the book. The book is available on Amazon.com, or you can go to www.thechemistrybetweenus.com. And it really lays out a lot of the work that's first done in animals to help us understand the chemistry, but then how that relates to humans as well.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
Any new projects that got you excited? Any new developments that you're working on?
We just got a new grant to study the effects of intranasal oxytocin in autistic individuals to see how it affects the brain regions that are involved in social reward. So we're actually going to be doing brain scans of both healthy subjects and autistic individuals, giving intranasal oxytocin or placebo so that we can see, actually peer inside the brain and see how this molecule is changing neural circuitry activity in both healthy subjects and autistic subjects. And I think this really is going to help us understand how the molecule is acting in the brain and help us figure out ways to develop the therapies that are really going to improve social functioning.
Wow, awesome.
That's awesome. Well, everyone else out there, you know, if you've had an insight today, which you most certainly have, it's important to act on it now, because if you don't do that, often you never will. And also, feel free to share this with people and also put it on your social media channels, because there are many people that could learn from this that are within your social network. So thank you, Dr. Young. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, and also maybe, if you have a friend or someone that you want to share it with, you want to give them a call this time. Instead of just dropping them an email or shooting them a message online, why not just give them a call and say, hey, I heard this interesting podcast today or show about chemistry, love, sex, attraction, you name it. And, you know, release that oxytocin and build that connection.
Yes, that's a very good point to make on this. So, yes, if you want to reach out and find out more about us, you can go to BrentSmithLifestyle.com, and you'll see all that we're up to and all the podcast interesting things we've had. And thanks again, Dylan. Thanks again, Dr. Young. And we will all speak to you all later.
Hey, thank you.